Welcome back. Having told everybody earlier that I wanted to leave plenty of room for discussion, and I told chairs, do your job and get the speaker to stop after 30 minutes, I thought I'd go first as chair and show people how it's done. But then Jeff's already told me he's going to ignore me and speak for 45 minutes anyway. So let's see who wins this battle.
Sorry. Insufficient advance notice.
Yes. But the intention is that you should stop sooner.
I'll try to speak faster.
Anyway, so please go ahead, Jeffrey.
Okay, thank you for coming. So there's the title, What Should a Forensic Scientist's Likelihood Ratio Be? If you'd like the slides, they're available here. If you don't have time to look at that, you can also get that link from the online program. And thank you to people who have graciously funded all of this. So I've actually been here since August, and some of the things I'm going to talk about are things that I've been thinking about longer than before August, but some of those I've been talking to people about here while I'm here, and this has been shaping my thinking on these matters. So I'm going to step back and ask what should a forensic scientist do, because I wanted an excuse to put up this quote from the National Research Council report, because it's often quoted. But I always have problems when this gets quoted. Because it seems to have an implication that what a forensic scientist should do is... Oh, hang on. Wrong button. Okay, it seems to have the implication that what a forensic scientist should do should demonstrate a connection between evidence and a specific individual or source. And I'm not quite sure what that means. And I'm not sure I would like to know what that means. There is another version of this same quote in the National Research Council report, which ends slightly different. It ends like this: support conclusions about individualization, more commonly known as matching. And this really scares me, because I think that suggests that you make a decision based on a posterior probability, and you make a yes-no decision by putting a threshold on a posterior probability. And I don't think that's what a forensic scientist should do. So probably for this audience, we probably all agree that what a forensic scientist should do is calculate a likelihood ratio. I'm going to assume that for this audience.
Probably incorrect.
Yes. Probably incorrect? Well, okay, that's another discussion that I'm not going to cover today. So other things in this quote that I'm not quite sure about is what does it mean by rigorously shown? Does that mean empirical validation? It might do, given everything else that's in the National Research Council report. What does consistently mean? Is this a question about precision? Is with a high degree of certainty about? Is with a high degree of certainty about validity? I'm a little concerned with this phrase here, because it says with the exception of nuclear DNA analysis, and I'm wondering if this means that you have to have likelihood ratios at least in the billions, and nothing else is any good, which I would dispute. So anyway, let's move on. What I'm going to talk about in the presentation, I'm going to focus on strength of evidence for presentation in court. I'm not going to be talking about investigative applications. I'm going to be focusing on source level comparisons, and I'm going to be thinking about continuously valued data. It's not to say that this might not be applicable in other fields, but please don't complain if what I'm saying you don't think is applicable to activity level, for example. And also, yes, I continuously valued, so this may not be about first approximation DNA models. So the question could be rephrased as, how should a forensic scientist arrive at the value for their likelihood ratio? Well, one response to that has been they can use experience and subjective judgment. So if we go to the Association of Forensic Science Providers Standards from 2009, what do they say? Whenever possible, probability estimates should be made. That's estimates is an interesting word. We might get to that later. Then it says personal data, such as experience in similar cases and peer consultation may be used. My definition of data does not include experience. I don't know about you, but I think it would be misleading if someone were asked in court, did you use data? And they said yes, and what they used was their experience and not what I would call real data. So I'm a little concerned about that. I'm a little concerned about experience in similar cases. Let me see, I've testified in 100 cases, and every time I said it was an identification, the defendant was found guilty, therefore that proves that what I do is correct. I'm a little disturbed by that. There is maybe use provided that the practitioner can justify the use of such data and demonstrate that it is soundly based. Okay, so you can't just, you have to justify it, except I don't think the AFSFP standard says anything about how one would go about justifying. Something else in that standard, probability assignments may be qualitative. So I will accept that there are occasions in which it might be useful for a forensic scientist to say, I think the probability of this evidence is much higher if the prosecution hypothesis were true than if the defense hypothesis were true, or vice versa, without being able to put a number on it. And I think you could probably always come up with some example and say, yeah, okay, in that situation I think it's okay, but I think that should be an exception. Right, so I'm not sure, we have to see how happy the courts are with these sorts of statements. So coming a little bit up, further up to date, but I think looking backwards, the MC Guideline of Evaluative Reporting, I think looked back to the Association of Forensic Science Provider Standards, because this first bit is almost exactly the same, except there's something added at the beginning, which disturbs me even more. Regardless of the existence of sources, published or not, of numerical data. So regardless of the existence of numerical data, personal data such as experience and peer consultation may be used. So this seems to be saying, even if you've got what I would call real data, you can make stuff up. You can use your experience, or you can ask your colleagues, what do you think? I think that's called crowdsourcing, yeah? But they do say something else. They do give an example. If the assessment is based on experience, the forensic practitioner will be able to demonstrate the relevant and documented previous professional activity. So this is how you justify it. But this gets back previous professional activity. Is that testifying in court before? That seems to be problematic. MC Guideline goes on. Forensic practitioners often experience difficulty in assigning and justifying probabilities when the assignments are based on expert knowledge. I would say that they might have problems with this because they're uncomfortable about it. They may not believe in it. I don't know. I haven't done any research on that. However, likelihood ratios can be informed by subjective probabilities using expert knowledge. The underlining is in the original. This to me looks like the doubling down. We're going to assert it more strongly. What else do they say? Such personal probability assignment is not arbitrary or speculative, or they're saying it shouldn't be, but is based on a body of knowledge that should be available for auditing and disclosure. You have to explain how you got there. Okay, but is this what actually happens? Oh. The buttons are too close together. Does this always get argued in court, or does the other side say, well, you know, we don't have the resources? to argue about this. Forensic practitioners should consider exploring the sensitivity of the likelihood ratio to different probabilities by examining the effect of assigning different probabilities according to their personal uncertainties. And I think now often the courts will get very unhappy about this because, well, first of all, we made up a number, and now maybe we can change that number and make up another number. I think it's getting to the issue of precision. But whether this is what the authors intended or not, I think this can be read in ways which might be very problematic and not give the courts confidence in what the forensic scientist is saying. So another example, a paper by Berger et al., which was in response to the R versus T judgment. The probability that is quoted will inevitably be a personal probability, and the extent to which the data influence that probability will depend on expert judgment. And as I read this, I think this is not just talking about, say, a Bayesian using prior probability distributions. It seems actually to be about the output being based on a subjective judgment. We stress that the probability may be informed not only by systematic research and data, but also by expert judgment. And the recognition of subjective probabilities as a sound basis for offering expert opinion should not be misconstrued as being an open door to unstructured reasoning and ad hoc guesses. Any appraisal offered based on the spectrum of knowledge an expert may call upon should be transparent and subject to peer review and challenge. So these are good words, but I'm still not convinced. One more example. This is from Leonard. I should have put two dates in because I think this was a keynote address in 2012 at the Australian New Zealand Forensic Science Society Conference. This is a bit different. This says, the issue is not that the LR is a calculated result from a mathematical model. Sorry, the issue is that the LR is a calculated result from a mathematical model. It is not an opinion. So Leonard seems to be contrasting the output of a statistical model with an opinion. And he suggests that the middle ground would be an expert opinion, exactly what an expert witness is expected to provide in the court, but informed, supported, and backed up by an appropriate statistical model. This, to me, seems to be suggesting that you can run a statistical model, you get the output of the model, and then you put that as input into a subjective judgment process. And he says the statistics should arguably only be presented if required. The evidence is the expert opinion and not the statistic. So do we have some contrary opinions about this matter? I think we do. We can go to US Federal Rules of Evidence 702. I'm showing you the pre-2000 version because I'm later going to talk about Daubert, which was talking about the pre-2000 version, since Daubert was 93. And if you're good at math, you'll figure out that 93 comes before 2000. If scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or to determine a fact in issue, a witness qualified as an expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education may testify thereto in the form of an opinion or otherwise. I want to unpack some of this vocabulary. I think this word opinion here is not the same as what Leonard was saying back here. So Leonard said that an expert opinion is not a statistic. I would argue that I think what the court is saying, what the court means by opinion here, is contrasting what an expert witness may do in contrast to what a lay witness may do. A lay witness may say what they observed, what they experienced. The lay witness cannot draw inferences. So Bill gave me an example. If somebody has slurred speech, the lay witness is allowed to say that they had slurred speech. The expert witness may be allowed to infer from the fact that they had a slurred speech that the person speaking was drunk. I hope it would require additional evidence, but the idea is that the expert is allowed to make inferences, whereas the layperson acting as a witness is only allowed to say what they observed. So I think what this means here is it's saying that the expert may make inferences. And I think that the output of a statistical model which calculates likelihood ratios is an inference based on the data. And so it is an opinion in that sense. Okay, what else have we got? We have the word experience in here, but notice where it is. A witness who is qualified as an expert, they can be qualified as an expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education. These are categories under which they can be qualified as an expert. That doesn't mean that they can just form a strength of evidence statement on the basis of their experience. It says that experience is one thing that can go into deciding whether they're qualified as an expert. After they're qualified, what do they have to do? Well, then they have to provide scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge that will assist the trier of fact. Right? And that may be in the form of opinion, i.e., they may be able to draw inferences from scientific, technical, or specialized knowledge. Right? It doesn't say that they can use their experience to form their strength of evidence statement. And this is, I think, what Daubert says about this. So this is Daubert, quote, explaining what this is all about, says, the adjective scientific implies a grounding in the methods and procedures of science. And we may get into all sorts of problems about what is science, but let's take modern practice and things that everybody, fields that everybody agrees are science. Similarly, the word knowledge connotes more than subjective belief or unsupported speculation. So I think that the court in Daubert hearing is saying that you need more than subjective belief. I should mention, I'm not a lawyer, this is not a legal opinion. There we go. Disclaimer. So, Reisinger gave a talk at the International Conference on Forensic Inference and Statistics in Seattle in 2011, and the published version is 2013. Here are some of the things that he says. It seems to me that the general modern Bayesian tradition encourages faulty expression by making it seem acceptable for people to obtain the probabilities that are incorporated into likelihood ratios by simply making their best guesses from experience, when more should be required. This may be a more or less educated guess, but it remains a guess nonetheless. There is something about the generation of likelihood ratios with numbers from nowhere that tends to cover up the weakness of the ingredients. In my own emphasis is not on the subjective nature of probabilities vel non, in this general sense, but on the empirical warrant that is or ought to be necessary. So we have people saying, well, maybe you can use a subjective judgment, but we need more. What might we need more? So coming way up to date since September, we go to the PCAST report. PCAST report says, neither experience nor judgment, nor good professional practices such as certification programs and accreditation programs, standardized protocols, proficiency testing, and codes of ethics can substitute for actual evidence of foundational validity and reliability. PCAST report is saying you need validity and reliability. The frequency with which a particular pattern or set of features will be observed in different samples, which is an essential element in drawing conclusions, is not a matter of judgment. So you might be thinking, well, this is about validity and reliability, and it's something different from assessing the strength of evidence. But in this sentence, this is about assessing strength of evidence. And they're saying this is not a matter of judgment. I would argue that, in fact, the PCAST report is somewhat confused about when it's talking about assessing strength of evidence and when it's talking about validating that assessment. I might get to that later. It is an empirical matter for which only empirical evidence is relevant, not a matter of judgment. What else does the PCAST report say? Similarly, an expert's expression of confidence based on personal professional experience or expressions of consensus among practitioners about the accuracy of the field is no substitute for error rates estimated from relevant studies. So this looks like we need empirical validation. For forensic feature comparison methods, establishing foundational validity based on empirical evidence is thus a sine qua non. Nothing can substitute for it. So the PCAST report, I think, takes a very extreme stance on this matter. It's a very empiricist stance. I think almost the exact opposite of the very subjectivist stance that we might have seen before. So the PCAST report is not commenting on law per se. It makes it very clear that what it's saying is that the courts have said that what matters is scientific validity, so we're going to talk about scientific validity. So if we go back to Daubert, Daubert says, how does the judge decide whether something is admissible? They can consider whether the reasoning or methodology underlying the testimony is scientifically valid, and whether that reasoning or methodology properly can be applied to the facts in issue. So the PCAST report is saying, well, the courts have said scientifically valid. We're going to talk about what is scientifically valid. This, I think, is important. Properly applied to the facts in issue. Also, whether a theory or technique can and has been tested. In the case of a particular scientific technique, the court ordinarily should consider the known or potential error rate. The statements constituting a scientific explanation must be capable of empirical test. And subsequent to Daubert, Rule 702 was modified. And the beginning part is basically the same. The order of the words have been moved around a bit. And we've got added in the testimony should be based on sufficient facts or data. The testimony should be the product of reliable principles and methods. And the expert has reliably applied the principle methods to the facts of the case. And if you don't get hung up on this word reliability, the courts throw around words like reliability without necessarily defining what they mean. And often they don't mean what a scientist would mean by a word like reliability. Daubert does actually, in footnote 9, says, well, there's scientific validity. In science, there's validity and there's reliability, and they mean different things. And what we mean here, when we say evidentiary reliability, that's based on scientific validity. Okay, so if you're a scientist, you go, okay, I think what happens is the courts don't put exact meanings on these words and they throw them around, but we get the gist of what they're asking about. Don't get focused on what you think the technical meanings of these words are, because the courts are not using them with the technical meanings. Just in case you thought this is only about the US, England and Wales criminal practice directions is basically a version of the Rule 702 from the US. Right? It's worded somewhat differently. It may not be exactly the same, but it's clearly inspired by Rule 702 and Daubert. And some of the things they have in there, sufficiently reliable scientific basis, consider the extent and quality of the data on which the expert's opinion is based, and the validity of the methods by which they were obtained. Consider the degree of precision or margin of uncertainty affecting the accuracy or reliability of those results. Again, don't get hung up on what, as a scientist, you might understand by the technical definitions of there. I think the gist of what they're saying is clear. So empirical validation matters. So I told Daniel he could talk about this later. I'm going to be your warm-up. So empirical validation, I don't care what the system is. I don't care whether the system is some sort of subjective judgment. I don't care whether it's based on a statistical model. I don't care whether it's a room full of monkeys with keyboards. I'm going to treat the system as a black box, and I'm going to test it as a black box. I'm going to put in pairs that I know to be same origin. And I'm going to look at the output. So I, as the tester, must know whether it's the same origin pair or a different origin pair. But the system being tested must not. If I put in the same origin pair and I get a likelihood ratio value out, and I say, you know, how good a likelihood ratio is that given I know that it was the same origin pair? If I put in a different origin pair, I ask the same question about the output. How good is the output given that I knew that the input was a different origin pair? I put in a whole bunch of same origin pairs, a whole bunch of different origin pairs, and I look at the average goodness of the results, and that gives me a performance metric. So I'm not going to go into any more details. Daniel might talk about that in more detail, about what sort of metrics you might use. So black box testing treats every system the same. The only criteria are input and output protocols. Unfortunately, the room full of monkeys has not followed the output protocol, and so they will be disqualified. Yes, I should. Well, Daniel's the second author on that. So if we don't like subjective judgments, what alternatives are there? Here's an alternative, which is just a minor modification on subjective judgments, I think. How about taking your subjective judgment but empirically calibrating it? So this is a bit like this black box testing that we just did. We get a bunch of input where we've got a bunch of same origin inputs and a bunch of different origin pairs to input. Each time we get an output, which is a likelihood ratio. Well, or it may not be. Now we've got a human. So this human judgment, they might be using an ordinal scale, for example. They might give you a number between -4 and +4. Right? We're going to call the output a score, just because we like to add vocabulary. We're going to call the output a score. And then what we do is we now have a bunch of same origin scores and a bunch of different origin scores. So scores that we know came from same origin pairs and scores that we know came from different origin pairs. And we're going to use those to train a system, a statistical model, which will be a score to likelihood ratio conversion model. And this is also called calibration. Right, so you can call it calibration, you can call it converting from a score to a likelihood ratio. So here's an example. This example is not based on either of these two papers, or it's not necessarily even based on use of an ordinal scale, but it gives you the idea. So we've got these blue circles are a bunch of scores that we got out of our judgment as a result of putting in same origin pairs. The red triangles are the result of the judgment outputs as a result of putting in different origin pairs. And then we fitted here a Gaussian distribution and here a Gaussian distribution, one distribution for each category. And then when we get a new input, we don't know what the answer is. Here's a pair. Tell us what your subjective judgment is. What value does that get on the x-axis? Here we go along to the x-axis, and wherever it is, we then say, how many times higher is this curve than that curve at that point? And that gives us a likelihood ratio. That gives us a calibrated likelihood ratio. So we can take subjective judgments and we can then put them into and we can then calibrate them. The downside is to do this training to get these training scores, you need to have the examiner do lots and lots of tests. And those tests actually have to be under conditions which are sufficiently similar to the conditions of the case that this is a meaningful calibration. Okay, another answer to what should a forensic scientist's likelihood ratio be? Dichotomous likelihood ratios. There's a fancy word. The PCAST report is at least suggesting the use of dichotomous likelihood ratios. I'm not saying it actually gets to fully elaborating on this, but it's got all the ingredients there. So what happens? The practitioner declares a match or a non-match. How do they decide? Well, they decide on whether the features in an evidentiary sample and the features in a sample from a suspected source lie within a pre-specified measurement tolerance. So there seems to be two ways that are envisaged in the PCAST report for this to happen. It could be a subjective judgment made by an examiner, or it could actually be based on making some real measurements and then applying some actual threshold. What happens next if a match is declared? Then the practitioner also reports the results of an empirical assessment of the probability of them declaring a match if the same source hypothesis were true, and the probability of them declaring a match if a different source hypothesis were true. How do you get that? You need to do some empirical experiments, which is just what we did before for the calibration. So the forensic examiner should report the overall false positive rate and sensitivity for the method established in the empirical studies of foundational validity and should demonstrate that the samples used in the foundational studies are relevant to the facts of the case. When I'm using italics, that's a direct quote. The PCAS record doesn't really dwell on the opposite, but I expect mutatis mutandis if non-match is declared. And I think this is actually not empirical validation. You can do two things. You can calibrate your results, and you're using empirical data to calibrate your results, but that's then not validation. You need a separate test set to test how well that system that you've just built works. Or you can use cross-validation, I guess. Is this a good idea? I think a number of people in this room actually co-authored this. We think not. Continuously valued data with within source variability, splitting that up into match versus non-match, dichotomizing the data, discards information that could be exploited by more appropriate statistical models. It suffers from a cliff edge effect. So if you were just below the threshold and just above the threshold, they would get very different strength of evidence answers. Whereas maybe they should have the same answer, more or less. Also, if you're just above the threshold versus way above the threshold, they'll get the same answer. Whereas one, maybe the one way above the threshold is stronger evidence. Trust me at the moment, because I'm not going to go into the details right now. I did some Monte Carlo simulations in which I've specified the population so I can calculate what the true likelihood ratio should be. The dashed line is the true answer. The solid lines are what you get out of putting a match non-match threshold on. This is a threshold put at a distance of one from the mean of the of the known source. You can see that the solid line and the dashed line are quite far away from each other. Here's RMS at a range of different thresholds, and the RMS values are always greater in this example than 0.25. Okay, other proposals. Present an ordinal scale. So here's an example of an ordinal scale taken from the PCAS, from the MC guideline on evaluative reporting. I'm assuming you've all seen these things before. These are being criticized, including by myself and my co-author. They've also been criticized in another paper recently published by Marcus et al. I think they actually do a much more in-depth reasoning of all of the problems with verbal scales, but they come to exactly the opposite conclusion. We say we don't think they should be used. They say they think they should be used. Although I think they do an even better job than we do of demolishing it. I think that's the power of priors. You probably all know ranges are arbitrary. There are cliff edge effects. There are the verbal expressions are vague. You know, they'll be interpreted differently by different individuals, and they'll be interpreted differently by the same individual in different contexts. And the meaning can only be made explicit via reference to numeric likelihood ratio values. So you have to explain that anyway. So if you actually have, to begin with, a numeric likelihood ratio to begin with, then just report that numeric likelihood ratio, is my proposal. If you have a subjective judgment to begin with, I would propose that you should empirically calibrate that and then report the subjective likelihood ratio value. Okay, so this is obviously my favorite option, numeric likelihood ratios. Some things that are important about calculating numeric likelihood ratios, however, they have to be based on relevant data. If you calculate your denominator using data taken from some other population than the population of interest in this case, then you're answering a different question than the question of interest in the case. Relevant data, quantitative measurements, statistical models. You need to validate the system under conditions reflecting those of the case. I think often This is not necessarily done all the time. Oh, we validated it in the laboratory. You can go out and use it. Well, you can only go out and use it if what was done in the laboratory is sufficiently similar to the conditions of the case. Obviously, in the first instance, it's the forensic scientist who's going to decide that. But in the last instance, I think that needs to be the decision of the judge at admissibility hearing or the trier of fact at trial. Okay, and then actually report the numeric likelihood ratio output of the model. If you do that, this is transparent. You can explain everything you did. It's replicable. Since it's transparent, you can explain everything. It's easy to repeat. It's easier to empirically calibrate, and it's easier to empirically test than a subjective judgment, just because once you've built this system, you can very quickly run through a whole bunch of test pairs. You can automate that process, whereas a subjective judgment procedure may require substantial investment of human time for each trial. It's resistant to cognitive bias if you do this, not if you take the output of that as input to a subjective judgment. But if you report the output of the model directly after you validate it, then you're resistant to cognitive bias. There are, of course, subjective elements at the beginning in deciding, what am I going to measure? Are these data that are appropriate for the question I'm trying to answer? What statistical model am I going to use? But all of those are at the beginning rather than at the output level. So then we run into the problem as there's different ways of calculating numeric likelihood ratios. And so one procedure is score-based. The basic idea for a score-based procedure is you're going to start at your original measurement, your feature level. You've got a question source datum. You've got some known source data. You may or may not have a relevant population data. You put those on. So they're a same pair, same origin pair or a different origin pair. You get out a score. You put the score in, and then you've got a bunch of same origin scores and different origin scores that you can then use to train up a model, and then you assess that. So that's the calibration that we saw before. Same idea. The question is, what are your scores? So some people use scores which are basically only different scores or similarity scores. For example, some of these different things. I would argue that if you're using scores, you should use scores which take account of both similarity and typicality. What does that mean? Well, basically, that's an attempt to calculate a likelihood ratio. But you don't consider the output directly interpretable. Maybe because you violated some modeling assumptions. Maybe you were trying to estimate a very large number of parameter values with a relatively small amount of data. Since we're short of time, I'm not going to get into the details here. So I'd be happy to explain it later. But again, so for now, I'll ask you to trust me. Those were the true likelihood ratio values. The solid lines are the ones based on a similarity-only score. And you can see that, in general, they're quite far away from the true values compared to when you use the similarity and typicality score. The solid lines are much closer to the true values. And here's the RMS error. So this was using a direct procedure for calculating likelihood ratios. Here's the similarity-only scores. There's the similarity and typicality scores. They are better than the similarity-only scores. And let's continue. Those are some actual, these are from a forensic voice comparison system. These are examples of distributions of actual similarity-only scores versus similarity and typicality scores. And if we calculate a likelihood ratio on this one, we're going to get much better performance than if we calculate a likelihood ratio on those. So the final topic, different procedures for calculating likelihood ratios. You may take a frequentist perspective, or you may take a Bayesian perspective. So if you're a frequentist, you're calculating your likelihood ratio based on sample data. And philosophically, what you're doing is estimating a true but unknown value. If you're a subjective Bayesian, you're going to use a prior distribution, sample data, calculate a posterior distribution, integrate out nuisance variables. Philosophically, what you're doing is you're quantifying a state of belief. You have a subjective probability or a personal probability. something that I'd been working on as a specialist on measuring and reporting the precision of forensic likelihood ratios. So we're interested in, can you measure the precision of likelihood ratios? Should you measure the precision of likelihood ratios? Here are some potential sources of variability in the likelihood ratios that you calculate. Why does this matter? Well, one of the reasons it might matter is we were talking about the forensic scientist's likelihood ratio. The trier of fact may not use the same likelihood ratio as the forensic scientist did. And it matters if I say, well, my likelihood ratio is 1,000 plus or minus 10% versus my likelihood ratio is 1,000 plus or minus two orders of magnitude. I think those are going to be interpreted, should be interpreted very differently. And the trier of fact might decide, gee, I'm going to use something which is closer to a neutral likelihood ratio of 1 based on what I've been told as this plus or minus interval. So the frequentist solution, if you're estimating a true but unknown value, it should be accompanied by an assessment of its precision. Subjective Bayesian, it's a state of belief, and your state of belief, you think, already incorporates all sources of uncertainty. So you're reporting a single value, except that value you're reporting may be closer to a likelihood ratio of 1 than the frequentist's best estimate. For example, if you use a reference prior, it's going to have very wide variance. And so you're going to end up with a likelihood ratio or a Bayes factor, which is much closer to a likelihood ratio of 1 than would be the best estimate for the frequentist. So if the trier of fact used the best, used something that was more conservative than the best estimate based on this estimate of precision from the frequentist, or if they just directly used the subjective Bayesian, maybe we have the same practical result. We end up with a likelihood ratio that's being used, which is closer to 1. And a question that I don't know what the answer is what's the which of these is best for the trier of fact? And so, final questions to end on. Can I use a Bayesian procedure if I decide we like that solution with a single value? Can I use that without buying into the subjectivist philosophy if I don't like that philosophy? For example, if I actually have informative priors, if I use empirical Bayes, if I use non-informative reference priors, and as I mentioned before, all approaches do have some degree of subjectivity. So saying subjective versus non-subjective may be a red herring. Okay, thank you.
Nearly all the time has gone. There is the possibility to discuss some of these things in the discussion session tomorrow afternoon, but now we probably only have time for about one question. Somebody would like to? Yeah.
I understand you promoting frequentist likelihood ratios.
Maybe.
Not tell me what you're promoting. And the question is, what are the situations where the numerical likelihood ratio procedure, as you think, does not apply? Or do you think it's a hammer for everything, like p-values and our Bayes factors?
So you're asking when would a frequentist answer not apply? One of the arguments is about do you have long-term frequencies? In the world I work in, if I have data, then I've got a sample and I could get another sample. And this argument about not having long-term frequencies doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think I am actually at the end of the day flexible in that I might quite like using a Bayesian techniques with reference priors. I probably haven't answered your question.
Yeah, but for instance, the last sentence in your abstract reads,
yeah.
He will leave plenty of time for discussion.
Oh, the abstract has changed.
Now, when I read that, my likelihood ratio, the two hypotheses, he will or will not.
You will.
On this data, which I take it in, is very different from if I take as my basis my experiences with any speaker who says that. You know? I get a very different one. So,
yes.
The world is full with uncertainty.
My apologies, I changed the abstract.
But it illustrates the problem that there are always so many likelihood ratios one can come up in a difficult, complex problem. So how to come up with which one?
Yes, and as I said, I think there will always be exceptions when I think somebody can come and say, would it be useful if the forensic scientist said this, even though they can't quantify it? And I will admit that there will be occasions. I would hope they would be exceptions. Or I would hope that would be where we should be heading to in the world of forensic science.
Okay, thank you very much. We should leave it there. And as I said, there might be an opportunity to discuss this further. The extensive discussion might come in the time slot tomorrow. For our next and final speaker before the drinks, it's a pleasure to welcome Daniel Ramos from Madrid, who has done a lot of work in voice comparison methods, but particularly in likelihood ratios to evaluate evidence for voice and other areas, I think. So please go ahead.
Thank you, David.